Hello and welcome everyone back to the Publisher Lab. My name is Manny Ramos, filling in for Tyler Bishop this week, but I am not alone on the podcast. I have my good friends and previous guests to the show, Terrence and Zach. How's it going, fellas?
Going pretty good.
It's going good. How are you, Manny?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you guys here. I got a few of these news stories on the docket. And I was hoping to get some experience notes from you guys. Let's get started with some Google news. With this news story that's titled, Does Google's Helpful Content Update Penalize AI Content? For content creators leveraging AI-generated content, there's been some burning questions. Does Google's recent helpful content update penalize AI-driven content? AI-generated content, which is text produced by software, can aid in scalability and improve content quality. However, Google's primary focus remains on the quality and relevance of the content, not its origins. The recent update promotes content tailored for specific audiences, showcasing expertise and fulfilling search intent. It's essential to understand Google's doesn't penalize AI content per se, but it does penalize poor content to ensure AI content meets Google standards, combining AI output with human editing. Especially using the Kraft editing framework, which is recommended, this framework emphasizes cutting unnecessary fluff, reviewing and optimizing, adding visuals, fact-checking, and ultimately building trust. In conclusion, Google rewards high-quality content, be it human or AI-generated. So I really wanted to get your guys' take, especially you, Zach. Since your expertise is an SEO, have you heard a lot of feedback from publishers regarding this Google helpful content update?
Well, as anybody probably listening to this podcast is aware of, the helpful content update's been quite impactful for hundreds of sites across the internet, especially in, it has not been kind to, I think, any niche.
No.
But when it comes to the use of AI, I really agree with what you said, Manny, in terms of from kind of search engine land's kind of documentation here. I said this previously on the podcast that Google is going to always pick the most helpful result. And it's really just a matter of time until AI is the most helpful result. There is, of course, an ecosystem that Google has to maintain with its publishers and with different content. But ultimately, AI is getting better and better and better. And the more that we continue to utilize it and feed it, the better and better it will become. I think utilizing AI is such a fantastic tool. I use it almost every day to help me do my job. It helps me analyze sites. It helps me analyze schema. Me and ChatGPT are good friends. So if I could send it a box of chocolates, I would, because it's super helpful. It really is. A human touch is crucial for it to get the best results, but it's really just a matter of time before it's the most helpful.
Yeah. No, I agree everything with what you said, Zach. And also, just to touch on the note of third-party tools detecting AI-generated content, that to me just sounds like an arms race where you have one tool that detects it and then you have another tool that's making it. But if it just keeps getting better after each iteration, well, you're going to get an arms race, which I just mentioned. And that means you'll never fully detect AI content. And as you said, if the content coming out of it is more and more and more helpful, then eventually just going to take over as, you know, sort of the de facto way we consume content. And of course, that human touch is needed today. But when we're talking about the future, that can change.
Yeah. And no, I like your comparison in terms of like an arm race, because it really is. I sound cliche. I want to say this, but it sounds kind of cliche that we're in like the Wild West of the AI kind of movement. But I do really wonder what, when we're the like predominant adult generation, when we're older and we can look back on this time, like what we will think about AI. Like, will we think of, oh man, that was a fad that, like, you know, we realized wasn't a good opportunity for the publishing space? Or did we realize, wow, that was really a primitive time? Now I just, you know, look in my Facebook Meta lens and it auto generates whatever I'm looking at, you know, whatever we find out. So I'm really curious to kind of know what we'll think about in this. Well, I guess so that's a question for you, Terrence. What do you think people will kind of look back on as like a really positive and maybe a negative of like this current time?
So I definitely think the latter is going to be the case, where we look back and we think this is more primitive.
I figured.
And the reason why I think that is, you know, I'm big into like a lot of sci-fi stuff. And how I see this happening is the way we consume content is basically we have a device, we read from it or we listen to it. But what we read from and listen to doesn't have to be something static that's written once, right? It can be adjusted based off of my input. Hey, order a pizza for me. And then it'll be like, what toppings do you want? Or if I say, hey, what's the best restaurant near me? Right? Then it'll just spit out some names. And I'm like, okay, go there, set directions. And then if I'm in my self-driven car, it'll just drive me there. So that's sort of how I see it, is the way we consume content in the future is going to be us just talking to a device or something and just going to do what we want it to do. We're not going to think about the article behind it. You know, we're just going to say, we have a question, we need an answer. And if we need information or something done, it'll just get it done. So I sort of see it as like fluid way where all the different mediums are just interconnected and working together to just help the end user, which is us, have more convenient and fulfilling lives.
Yeah. At the end of the day. And I wonder, because currently the system we have is there's an ecosystem behind the publisher space. There's an ecosystem behind kind of everything. Google makes money, publishers make money.
Yep.
And everyone in between is kind of happy. But with the model that you just put forward, which I agree with, I think that would probably be the next step in kind of technological innovation.
Yeah.
But then it's like, well, then what's the business model there? You know, like where did the ecosystem go? Because it has to fall somewhere unless it just falls apart.
100%. And, you know, Google's not going to kill its golden goose, right? They need people to make content to fulfill search results in order to keep people on the search engine so that they can sell ads to advertisers on Google search. So it puts Google in an interesting position where they don't want to hurt their business model as much, but they still can't like push back the inevitable. So that's one aspect. And number two is behavioral changes, right? Everyone is so used to typing in a keyword in a Google search. Now they're getting a little bit more accustomed to typing in sentences to a generative AI. But the behavior change happens a lot slower than the technological change. So imagine, you know, you have your grandparents, right? They barely know how to Google search. And then you have your parents. They barely know how to use generative AI or something like that. So the behavioral change is going to take a lot slower. So what we're talking about isn't something that's going to happen overnight. It's going to be like a long, slow grind until people actually get used to using it more often. And then the technology side is developers making apps and phones that all work together. And then the background will be like applications that run those things. And that's probably where the business model would be.
Yeah. Goodness.
Yeah.
That's such a crazy insight. Because I agree, like, as you're saying it, I'm like, yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. Because you're right. Yeah. Like, my grandparents know nothing about how to Google things. Yeah. My grandmother, she was trying to give me recommendations on, like, where I should go to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And she printed out a website and sent it to me.
Yeah.
It was like, you should look at this web, an actual piece of paper in the mail, and said, you should look at this website. I was like, oh, Nana.
Exactly.
I love you. But so I think you're really right that there's going to be generational gaps that are going to continuously be improved upon. And I think, people will probably just start marketing towards generative AI and it'll go in that direction. But to kind of tie it back to more of the helpful content update, back to penalizing AI content. If you are utilizing AI content to make the best content possible that answers the user's question as best as you can, odds are you're going to do fine.
Yeah.
I've said this a few times already today, and I'm sure I'll say it a few more times this week. We still have two updates rolling out as of today, the spam update and the October core update. So the dust isn't even done forming yet before we can even say it's settling. So we still have probably another month of volatility before we get some stabilization. Yeah. So we'll find out.
100%. And before this podcast, we were talking a little bit earlier. And one important thing that you mentioned that really stuck out to me is you can use AI to help you a ton, but you still need to have like your unique perspective and experience. Basically, you know, curate it with the craft, cut the fluff. You got to edit, revise it, you know, build trust with a personal story, a tone, or links. So that's still going to be important. And if you look at, I think we talked about some of the changes in search results, how like big brands, more trusted brands are becoming top of the search result, more so than other smaller sites. So it looks like Google's definitely pointing towards, hey guys, we want to trust a big brand in what we think is a helpful search result instead of, you know, someone that has a similar result, but maybe we don't know the person behind it.
Yeah. And I think, and the question is going to continue to become, how do you become more helpful than the brand?
Yeah.
How do you become the authority on the topic that a brand can so reliably give information on? And I think the answer to that, I think a part of the answer to that, I'm not even going to try and answer that right now. Yeah. That's a long, long answer. But I think that the start of it is asking ourselves the question of how can we creatively use AI to help us?
100%.
Because I think a lot of times publishers may get caught up in just giving, like ChatGPT, for example, just a quick sentence on do this for me within a sentence. But really, it should be you give it so much information that it almost can't produce you something negative.
Exactly.
Like if you give it 15 different parameters on what you want it to write or what you want it to generate for you, instead of two, you're going to get such a more in-depth result. And so if you ask it, write this in a first person perspective, write it as if you had driven in this car before, write it as if you've done this, because obviously the recommendation coming from Google is you need to write reliable, helpful content that's, you know, obviously AI supported, but you want to, you know, have it come from yourself and kind of come from the heart, which, of course, if you have that experience, please do it. But the reality is a lot of people are just using AI.
Yeah.
And so I think the more heavily people push into it and really rely on it as this great resource that you can curate to what exactly you want for your specific niche, and then give it competitors too. Give it the competitors that are against you. Make sure that it knows this is your competition. I think it's the Wild West. People are going to get better. Their draws are going to be quicker, and yep, guns are going to get bigger. So it's going to be really interesting to see how people use it.
I guess like one final note is I agree with everything you say, and especially on that note of creativity, like the publishers and content creators that can leverage AI the most to be more creative are going to be the ones that succeed the most, right? So a couple anecdotes from me using it personally is, I don't know if you've used the same prompt 100 times in a row, but you start to notice if you do, there'll be certain patterns. And basically, a generative AI model will have certain keywords it generally follows. Well, if you do the same input and output over and over again.
Interesting.
So the way you have to do to get around this problem is you have to frame it like tell this like I'm a 5-year-old, tell this like I'm a 12-year-old, tell this like I'm a 17-year-old, tell this like I'm an average American citizen. And when you frame it like that, it actually does shift the language patterns a little bit. So that's how you can be a little bit more creative and a little less subtle. So that when the average reader looks at it, they're not like, oh, I've recognized this word in other AI-generated content. So that's how you can make it sound more genuine and authentic.
Yeah, and this actually, we've talked about this for a while now, but I think it's really important and fun to talk about that. Like Google's spam, man, I think it's called Spam Brain mm-hmm. AIs, like their generative system. Oh, it's the natural language processing model that they have to identify spam and AI generated content, because Google can tell if it's AI. And that's probably a big reason for it, yep, for what you just said there. They know the syntax and the diction that they can find across sites, and they'll find the patterns. If they find those patterns and it's not good content, they'll dock you.
They'll dock you. 100%.
And so, yeah, I think that's a really good recommendation. As far away as you can get from
the default output.
Yeah, is try it like in giving it as many parameters on syntax, on diction, on clarification, on writing it in tone, like tone. There's so many different things you can add on to it to make that as creative as possible. I mean, I think people, the more people start pushing outside the box in this way, the better. And yeah, I think it's going to be really cool to see what people come up with.
100%.
Yeah, I think all of that is great information, especially with AI just being so dominant. We were talking before the podcast, like there's going to be a moment where we think of AI kind of like smartphones, where there was a before and after everyone had smartphones, there was a before and after everyone had AI. But sticking with Google and AI, I wanted to jump into the next topic, which is Google Extended does not stop Google search generative experience from using your site's content. So last week we covered Google Extended, So any publishers who are concerned with AI being, or with their content being crawled by AI and then being used for these generative softwares, were really concerned about their content essentially just being stolen. So Google rolled out this Google Extended, which promised to remove their site from the AI crawlers. However, if you're using the Google Extended token in your robots.txt to prevent Google from utilizing your site's content for AI projects, it might not be as effective as you think. Google has clarified that this token does not stop your content from appearing in AI-generated answers on the Search Generative Experience, or the SGE. This means that even if you've blocked your content for AI purposes, the SGE can still display AI-generated answers from your site. To manage this, you'd need to use standard search directives. So for those wanting to maintain control over where and how their content appears, it's crucial to be aware of these nuances. So I know, Terrence, that you have a few websites. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this? Like, where Google says, yeah, we're going to have a system where we're going to protect your content from AI and we won't use it. But then there's almost like a backdoor to still using that content.
Yeah. So how I see this is, if you publish content and you let Google index it, you're basically giving up the rights to let, or you're basically giving up like your ownership of that content to Google in a sense. So what this means is, hey, we're not going to be using your content for our Bard tool, our Vertex AI tool, which is, you know, their like own large language model, which is used to train on mass amounts of data. But they're still going to use it for the search generative experiences. And I don't know how many people have played around with this. I have. When you Google something, this generative search experience will pop up right away and it will just start typing based off your query. And then that result that it gives you will be a like kind of like a ChatGPT answer, but then it'll have links to websites in that result. So if the link is your site or someone else's site, you get some credit there. However, I think this all falls into the same bucket of basically, you know, as a publisher, Google is the biggest platform to get your content out there. So you kind of have to let Google crawl your site. And if you block Googlebot entirely, you're basically saying no to Google search, which is a massive source of traffic. I don't think anyone in the right mind will actually do that right now. But what you see happening is slowly over time, less clicks are going to go to non-Google sites, which there's some data I've looked at this in the past. I think 60% of all Google queries don't result in a click to a non-Google site. And that trend is only going to continue, because if someone's using the generative search experience to get their answer, then they're going to stay on the Google search result page instead of going to your website. And it doesn't matter if a tool like Bard or Vertex AI isn't using your content, because what matters is traffic coming to your site from Google search.
Yeah. And I think that is a hesitation for some. Like, I can understand people's hesitation that they're not wanting to lose the merit and lose kind of the effort that they put into a lot of their articles. 100%. And so it totally makes sense of the hesitation of wanting to kind of accept this model. But I completely agree with you that if you're putting your content out there, I mean, you're giving it essentially to the public. It's like standing on a street corner and sharing it with the world.
Yeah.
But worse. And so, like, there are a lot worse things that could happen with your content than Google taking it and utilizing it within their model. Mm-hmm. And if anything, yeah, I agree. I've played around with it as well. And yeah, they're pretty good about linking to the source that they're getting it from. I mean, which, you know, ChatGPT doesn't use that. You know, they use a completely different model. So Bard's, if anything, is a positive AI for a publisher experience. Yeah. So I think that I wouldn't be too worried about it in terms of this impacting people's site performance, because, yeah, you're right. 60% of searches of the billions that happen, you know, every week, do not end up in someone clicking on a site. And so you only have a 40% opportunity. And yeah, that's going to continue to go down, as the conversation we've already had so far today is the world's kind of moving in this way of, we have to think, what will be the most helpful result within a year?
Yes.
And the more helpful result is, I don't want to have to look through an article. I don't want to have to click on a website. I want to just find it. I want to just have it. And Google knows that. And that's why this started with couple of years ago, people kind of maybe, I don't know what the response was. I wasn't in the SEO industry at the time, but like, I wonder when rich results started appearing, mm-hmm. I wonder what that response was then of like, ah, no, like, were people also being like, no, like, it's going to take my clicks. And I think this is just another variation of that. You know, the technology is just getting better. Google's innovating and they're going to innovate again and again and again. And it's just going to, you have to just keep answering the question, why are you the most helpful? And I think if you keep answering that question well, you'll probably do okay.
Yeah, 100%. I kind of relate to publishers in this way where I have seen sites that I own that have been impacted by the helpful updates I just mentioned, and then coming into this trend that we're noticing where more and more traffic is kind of being siphoned away. So it comes down to me as a website owner would be, how do I make my website, my brand, my content as unique and as helpful as possible so they can't get it anywhere else? Now, if I have the most unique, most helpful content and I put it on Google search, then I also give that helpfulness and uniqueness to Google at the end of the day. So this is where I'm big into branding and sort of how can you diversify where your traffic comes from. So then you see things like this happening. Back in the day, we had the snippets happen. Same sort of thing where a publisher's like, I'm losing my clicks to Google. Well, this is going to have a similar result to that. Maybe to a further extent or less extent. I'm not sure exactly. But it's the same thing. It's how do you diversify your uniqueness and helpfulness of your content that, you know, is in Google search, but maybe outside of Google search. Maybe you have social media platforms, you know, video content, you know, having sort of like a different way to express your content. Maybe you hop on a podcast and talk about it, right? There's multiple things you can do to sort of expand your brand. And I think that's the approach where we're seeing things headed.
Yeah. And that reminds me, I was recently on a publisher call. If you're listening, you know who it is. There where they said, you know, one thing they didn't expect when they started their website was that they were going to have to become a marketer and enter into the marketing space. And I agreed with them. I was like, yeah, that is something that people, when they start a site, they're like, man, I love movies. I'm going to write a blog about movies. And then all of a sudden you are competing with IMDb and IGN and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to promote myself if I want to keep this up. And yeah, I think that's a fantastic, not only recommendation, but opportunity for people to expand upon their content and to think really creatively. There are so many things out there that people still haven't done, that people haven't thought of, that people are going to continue to keep innovating with. And the more that people get comfortable with expanding their opportunities outside of the sphere of just writing blogs and just writing how-tos and these different op-ed kind of pieces, but instead start thinking, well, what kind of videos can I make? What kind of answers can I make in this medium? How can I market myself on Pinterest? How can I market myself here? And the more that they kind of diversify that brand.
Tools or some other service you offer too.
Yeah, like, and increasing that digital footprint is really a positive thing. 2 years ago, that was positive, and it's positive today now too. So it's an old recommendation that is still something that's important, just maybe a little bit more amplified.
100%.
Excellent. So I did want to move on. So we are going to go from a moment where your content is being used by generative AI to users using that generative AI and potentially having that content copyrighted. So in a significant move, Google has announced that its commitment to defend users of its generative AI systems on platforms like Google Cloud and Workspace if they face accusations of intellectual property violations. This pledge mirrors similar promises made by tech giants Microsoft and Adobe. However, it's essential to note that this protection doesn't cover instances where users deliberately infringe on others' rights. While most AI-related lawsuits have been aimed at the companies owning these systems, Google's move ensures that individual users have a safety net, emphasizing the ongoing debate around the AI copyright laws. So if someone were to go in and use generative AI from Google and that information was pulled from a website and that website then says, hey, that's my information or my data, you're not allowed to use that. We're kind of going back to the same thing. If your content is public on Google and that content is bringing traffic to your site, it's kind of for fair game for anyone to use, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what we just said too, and this is reminding me of a very unfortunate, not a quote, but an unfortunate idea that it'll take something big and something perhaps even tragic before the laws are going to catch up with this. Mm-hmm. Like, even just the idea of an AI generative US law is kind of like, what? Like, yeah. I don't, speaking as someone in the industry, I'm like, I don't even know what that would be. What, like, and so I think this is maybe the twinges, the beginnings of it, that it's going to be coming into copyright. But at a point when you have something, we've never dealt with something generative before that no. automatically does something for us that pulls it from something else. Like, that is 100% new to the human race. So it's going to be very interesting to see. I mean, personally, I'm glad that Google said that it's going to defend its users in that way. Because it does go back to what we said. If you're publishing content, you're essentially standing on a street corner with a megaphone. Like, if you yep. didn't want to be, if you didn't want your content to be used in that way, this may not be the best industry to be in, because people are going to use it all the time. People scrape content all the time. People use your content all the time. And that's kind of the whole name of the game. So I think that this does positively impact publishers, and maybe will give people a little bit of a peace of mind. Because some people could think of this negatively of like, ah, darn, like I would want to use that to like get back at people. It's like, yeah. well, use it to your own advantage too. You know, make sure that you're using the AI systems as well to pull from this and quote that and utilize that system to promote your own content. I mean, to buff up your own content. But yeah, when the first AI law gets published, I'll be shocked to find out what it is.
Yeah, I know that like a handful of countries are working to put together some AI laws. And I know that the U.S. Congress recently had a meeting with all the tech giants. So I know that there's a few things in place. So I know politicians are aware that AI is going to be a problem. I just don't know if we have a solution that we can all kind of get around. But moving on to social media news, we did want to cover a topic. Grayskai, a new third-party app for the Twitter alternative Blue Sky, is set to launch on both iOS and Android platforms later this month. This app promises to enhance Blue Sky's experience, boasting features like GIF support, inline translations, and unique feed-first layout. While the iOS version is currently available for pre-order in the App Store, the Android users can expect the version soon. Initially, Grayskai will be free, but the company plans to introduce a subscription service for advanced features in the future. Now, what's really interesting is that Blue Sky is a company, I believe, founded by Jack Dorsey, who originally founded Twitter. So with this coming out, and you kind of have heard a bunch of different apps on this podcast, including Threads, Mastodon, and a few others that are essentially just Twitter clones. We've been seeing a lot more of this. And I know the big issue is having users go onto this platform and then actually continue using the platform continuously, which has been a big problem that we saw with Threads. How are you guys feeling about this big transition in apps where X or Twitter used to be so dominant, and now we're just starting to see a bunch of different copycats? And are there any that you guys are using that have stuck with you guys?
Yeah, I guess I'll kick it away with my thoughts. So how I see it is there's clearly a need for this open, like, I guess, marketplace of ideas on an app form. And that was the original promise of Twitter. Now X, after Elon Musk purchased it. So with Blue Sky coming out, my opinion right now is wait and see. And the reason I have that opinion is because Threads had a massive launch and had, I think, it broke records on first application to 10 million users in a short period of time. But Threads was an interesting launch because it linked up all existing users from Facebook and Instagram. Basically, an Instagram account, it immediately made you an account and immediately followed all the people that were on your Instagram on Threads. So it kind of had that blow up effect instantly. But then you noticed, as Manny just mentioned, people didn't stay. Instead, people that went from X to Threads are now back on X. And the reason for that is when you have a platform that's an open idea marketplace, you need people to respond to you. You want to go to where the people are at. You know, where are the celebrities? Where are the influential ideas? And right now, those people are still on X. So people will still use X because of that. Now, Blue Sky can accomplish what Threads didn't, which is get people to use it, then stay using it. Then I think it would be a serious competitor to X now. However, that is a lot easier said than done. And I would be interesting to see how it's marketed and how the ease of access is, how easy it is to create accounts. Because right now, if it's just a brand new account you got to create, you know, if I go ask someone on the street, what's Blue Sky? They have no idea. If I ask them what Twitter is, they'll probably know. So they run into that problem. I know Jack Dorsey was the original mind of Twitter. And he probably has some great ideas with Blue Sky here. But you're still coming to a space that's already established. So it's going to take some work to pull those users from X and bring them on Blue Sky permanently.
Yeah. And I think that it's going to be really interesting to see how even Twitter / X, I'm just going to say Twitter because yeah, it's easier. It'll be interesting. Exactly. But that speaks to what Terrence just said. People are always going to call it Twitter because it's just so well known. I mean, it's been around for over a decade. It's so synonymous with the social media. The bird logo is just so well known. And yeah, I think they will have a lot of stiff competition coming up, especially even just from an SEO perspective. I mean, my expertise is obviously in SEO, so I'm going to keep it in that realm. That, you know, so many people right now currently use Twitter to not only promote their articles, to promote their own content, to promote themselves as, oh, I have X amount of followers, X amount of people on here. And so I think it's currently a positive tool for SEO to get your content out there and to be engaged. As I just said, like increasing your digital footprint, I think that's a very positive thing to be involved with. Blue Sky is going to need to give people a reason to use it.
100%.
And it's going to need to give them some sort of profitability because social media is social media. There's so many different ways that you can interact with it. But I think if one of the things that will make it longstanding is a profitability standpoint.
The monetization aspect.
Monetization and, but just profit or I guess usefulness. Usefulness to another ecosystem that's outside social media. Because if I want to just doom scroll and like just look at people's content, I'm just going to keep using Twitter.
Like, it has better content on there.
It has better content. There's millions and millions of people use it. You can follow, you know, whatever niche that you want to be involved in, you can follow it. And without Blue Sky having kind of that additional value add from an SEO perspective, I don't see it, you know, being super successful. But then again, Jack Dorsey, if he has a lot of great ideas up his sleeve and has like some different ways that he's going to want to help people monetize it, help people kind of help create their brand with Blue Sky, then I think it's got a good shot. But currently, Twitter does that tenfold.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's what I think is going to keep them in the running for months and years to come, is that it's so synonymous with branding. It's so synonymous with social media. I mean, you have Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Like those have been
those
like
the ones.
And now YouTube has recently joined that in, I feel like, the last like 2-3 years, as that's basically become another search result. So I'd say that that's probably another like giant in there. But really those four, you know, I don't like it. It'll be hard to dethrone that. But then again, we thought that search results would be hard to dethrone. And here we are talking about generative AI. So who knows? If they innovate, I could see it happening.
Yeah. I would say also a point on Twitter alternatives. And I hear this a lot when, you know, Twitter has had lots of news in the past of, you know, Elon doing stupid stuff. It's just kind of been a train wreck, let's say. It's been hilarious to watch. But one thing that people think is going to happen, which is, oh, all these users on Twitter have a bone to pick with Elon, so they're going to go to Blue Sky, and then that's going to bring users over. I just don't think that will be the reason. As you said, I think there needs to be a clear monetization solution for these content creators. Right? If I'm a content creator on Twitter and I get paid predictable revenue and I know how to go like figure out how the algorithm works a little bit to get virality into my content, I'm going to stick there because that's where the users are. Now, if Blue Sky has those users and I can make maybe a higher rate on my post, maybe like the CPMs are higher for ads there, then I would 100% go to Blue Sky and make content there.
Yeah.
Right? It's going to depend on how much advertisers are willing to pay for the content there or to show their ads within the content. It's going to show on depend on how engaged users are with that content. And also going to depend on how many good content creators they can get. So those three things, I think, are what they need to really focus on in order to dethrone the established Twitter at the moment.
Yeah, and that's the same model with a lot of, I mean, you could apply that same model to any of the big social media.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Like one that's coming into my mind, if people are familiar with Twitch, which I feel like a lot of people probably will be, like it's a giant, you know, gaming, streaming kind of platform. People have been trying to dethrone Twitch for years. It's been probably the predominant streaming kind of service for probably a decade now.
Yep.
And YouTube, Kick, Facebook tried doing it. There was another one that tried doing it.
The Microsoft one.
The Microsoft one. All of them failed. Another one that's coming to mind, a different niche. People have been trying to dethrone like Spotify and Apple Music. Do you remember Tidal? Is Tidal still a thing?
Yeah, Tidal. I don't know if it is still a thing.
Tidal is still a thing. It's just, it doesn't have anywhere near the same amount of users as Spotify or Apple Music.
Exactly. And like, I remember, like, and so they tried that method. They got Kanye West to release his album. Life of Pablo? I think it was Life of Pablo. That he tried to release there. It did not work. No. It didn't work because they answered only one of those questions. Well, we got a great creator on here. So you guys should come over. You have to meet every single demand. Exactly. That like you had like so for Spotify does so many things well. Apple Music does so many things well. And a competitor needs to not only answer all those questions, but more.
Exactly.
And Twitter, it's going to be the same thing for Blue Sky. They have to answer every single query. I mean, every single need that someone gets from Twitter currently and then some. What makes it better? And if you can't give a really good answer, then people are just not going to buy it. Same thing with like, with really anything.
Yeah. It's like any competitor coming into a space, right? If you have two products that are basically the same, but one has all the users, the one product that is the same that has no users is not going to just magically steal them all. You need to be better than the one with all the users in order to get people to use it.
Yeah.
It just comes down to if you're a competitor in any space, how do you make your product the best there is? And right now the game on these platforms is, how do you keep your content creators happy? So monetization solution, as I mentioned earlier. How do you make that the experience good enough for users? And how do you make sure good content keeps getting produced?
Yeah.
Like it's going to come down to that. And if they can hit those and users like, you know, see, oh, I found this thing on Blue Sky. It was a great thread, right? Then that tells me, okay, maybe there's some good stuff on there. And then you hear that again and again and again. Then more and more people will use it. So it's definitely, if it overtakes Twitter, it won't happen overnight. It won't happen instantly. It would be like a slow word of mouth if it was really good.
It'd be a slow burn. And yeah, I completely agree with you.
I agree with both of you guys. Yeah, I didn't include this story on the docket, but I saw that Twitter was going to start charging new users in the Philippines and a few other countries. So it's really going to be a test to see like, what can Twitter do to push the users away from their platform? And that's when we're going to see these other platforms really come in and start taking some of that market share.
Yeah.
Moving on to our last story of the day, we're going to do some AI news. Kobe Fuller, a general partner at Upwork Ventures, is pioneering a new approach to blogging. Leveraging the power of generative AI, Fuller is turning traditional blog posts into interactive micro-topics. These AI-driven conversations showcased on his website, Kobe.ai, allow users to engage with content in a more dynamic way. While this innovative approach doesn't aim to replace traditional blogging, it offers a fresh and interactive method for readers to connect with content. Now, we did a brief showcase of this, or I did a brief showcase of this to the guys right before we started the show. It's really like if there's a topic that he's covering, you click on it. It gives you a short little blurb. And then if you have any additional questions regarding the topic, you just have a conversation with an AI, almost like if you're reaching out to an expert to answer any of those questions. I think it's a really cool new approach to blogging. What do you guys think about it?
As Manny mentioned, this is basically an AI built into your blog post where, let's say you have a blog post about, I don't know, let's pick a topic, BMW cars, right? And you can click generate or talk to the AI. And you click on it and it opens up a chat interface similar to ChatGPT. and that chat interface is like primed with that topic. So then you can just fire away being like, how long has this model been released for this BMW? What's the gas mileage on this? And you can start asking specific questions about the topic to basically learn more about it. So it's basically a way where you can take any article and then just immediately ask more in-depth questions about it in a chat interface. I think it's a pretty cool idea and definitely goes back to what we talked about earlier with the publishers that will succeed in this day will be the creative ones. And this is a creative solution to an old format that has been around for, you know, like almost 20 years or more, right? Blog posts been around forever. But I still think there are some ways you can expand on this instead of maybe transferring to a whole new chat window. You can maybe have the chat window within the article so you can click on different points and say, expand on this. I have further questions on this point here. It really just opens the box on how users can interact with content with the end goal, you know, of giving the user what is helpful and what is unique and, you know, making you the trusted source for that content. So I think it's a new creative way to think about how you can leverage current blog information in new ways.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really cool experiment. From what I believe we read when we were on the site right before the meeting, the creator was pretty upfront that this was an experiment. This is like a personal project that like, I want to see how this works. I want to see like, what can we get the AI to do? What results can we get? What data can we pull from it? And then maybe go from there. And I think that that is a fantastic approach that I think is really needed in this space at the moment of being really creative without the intention of needing a result, of being okay with, I wonder what's going to happen. I wonder what we can get out of this and what, and kind of being open to what data comes in. And I think that's really important right now to kind of be open to that because a lot of people are just so results driven right now with such a new venture of AI that a lot of times they just get disappointed. So I think kind of having an open viewpoint on that is a great idea. And I'm going to keep tying this back to SEO because, you know, why not? You know, I would encourage people to try. I I'm going to probably from this meeting, from this podcast, I'm going to go and try and play around with this to see, you know, what kind of information can I get from it? And then, you know, kind of, you know, use this as a source almost of like in blog posting of like, this is what Kobe Fuller, you know, had to say. This is what this generative AI partner, you know, had to say about this topic as, you know, oh man, if you're thinking about buying a, you know, an M3 from DMW, this is what this had to say about its, you know, tire pressure. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I think there's so many opportunities people can continue to use this from. And as more and more generative AI tools like this continue to be created, it just continues to open up the doorway for people to be more creative, to provide some useful content in a single hub that others may not have access to. And I'm excited to see where this ends up. But yeah, kudos to the creators of this tool and excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, just to touch on a little bit, what this gave me an idea of is right now, if you want information on the internet, you go to Google search, you type something in, it gives you a result, you click on the result and you see if it answers your question. If it doesn't, you go back. Or if you have another question, then you go and do another search result, right? So the way you research something like about a topic, let's say you want to buy a car, for example, you keep going from Google search to Google search to Google search until you have a ton of tabs open of different websites trying to get the information you want that is sort of everything you need to know about a topic. So for example, I'm trying to buy like, I've been looking into Teslas a lot lately, right? And the websites I use are, there's far and many in between, but one is like the depreciation curve of a Tesla. One is like someone's personal experience of a Tesla. One is someone's review of a Tesla. One is the different, you know, features and what they offer, right? But to answer those questions, I'm going to many different websites and many different sources that get that information. Some is on Tesla's website. Some is on a car website dedicated to, you know, depreciation curves on cars. So one is maybe a site about a loan calculator, right? To, you know, fine tune your monthly payment. But imagine if I could, as a user, get all of that research done within one website in one session. To me, that is where I see the value to the user. And now if the user can do that, guess what? They're staying on your site for longer. They're more engaged with your site for longer, right? They're not going back to Google search. I'm sure it's probably a positive signal to them. To Google, And at the end of the day, you might retain a long-term user. If you have a newsletter, the chance they type in that email there might go up. The chance they remember your site might go up because, like, man, I did this entire research session in one go without leaving the site. That was amazing. So that is how I see this is expanding the game of content creation. And I think it's actually pretty exciting because it changes how websites are used and how research is done a little bit on the internet. If you just expand a little bit further on that idea, I know the actual demo on the site isn't that, but it gives me the idea of what so much more of what it could be.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And it opens up the possibility of what things can be in the future and how a lot of user experiences can be impacted by the innovation of others. So yeah, it's really exciting to see where it'll go.
Yeah, super cool.
It's going to be really exciting to see how the internet just kind of progresses now that AI is a thing. We're going to start seeing more websites pop up like this. So it's just really exciting to see. That's a perfect transition to take us into our AI tool of the week. So last week we started this new segment where we feature a brand new AI tool that we've been using. This week I got a scheduling calendar tool called UseMotion. It's usemotion.com to go to the URL, and the app is called Motion. So this is an AI calendar. So I have a lot of things going on, personal and professionally, as well as side gigs and freelance. So there's always something going on in my schedule. And I feel like a lot of the times I used to keep everything in notes. But with this calendar tool, what I end up doing is inputting all of my tasks, assigning how long the task should take, if there are any blockers, if it's associated with another task that requires me to kind of go in order to get them done. And let's say one day I have on my calendar to do this podcast or do the podcast notes, but something comes up. There's always emergencies. You always have to kind of tend to things, and something else gets in the way. Instead of that task just kind of staying backlogged in your calendar, or you having to then think, okay, when can I now fit this task in my schedule to still make sure that I meet deadlines, this will automatically do that. So it'll take your calendar. You can assign personal hours, work hours, day, night, whenever you want. And then you kind of just input these tasks in there, and it's like your personal assistant. Whereas instead of having to call someone and say, hey, cancel my 3 o'clock meeting today. So yeah, it kind of gives you the goal of this app is to give you additional time in your week by helping you prioritize your tasks and just kind of filling in your free time. Some of the copy from their website, Motion's intelligent calendar takes your meetings, your tasks, your to-do list, your activities, and creates one perfect optimized schedule to get it all done. It's really good for publishers, I believe. If you have a lot of content that you need to write on short deadlines or schedules that you need to meet, this is a great app for you guys to use. Have you guys used any apps similar to this, or do you guys think that this is something that could be useful for your calendars?
I mean, yeah, I don't really use anything for my calendars right now. My work's schedule used to be, well, it depends, ebbs and flows. Some days I'm super structured and I have everything planned. Other days it's kind of just whatever hits me, I take care of. So if this calendar can handle the problem of not every day is the same, or some days you're going to have a ton of heads down work, but other days you're going to be helping colleagues or have meetings, if it can handle that flexibility, then 100% I'll use it. But I know I haven't played around with it.
That's one of the beauties that I find with this calendar. So you're able to integrate all of your personal calendars, your work calendars, so then it actually auto-populates with all of your meetings and anything that you have scheduled in your work calendar, and then kind of just plans out your life so that you don't have to plan it yourself.
Does it, is it smart about, like, if let's say you have a meeting every Tuesday, but you don't have it on your calendar, but maybe, I don't know.
Like a reoccurring task?
Yeah.
Yes. So you can assign reoccurring tasks. So even if it's something as simple as like exercising 3 times a week, it'll make sure to assign, you know, specific days of the week or whatever, wherever it can fill it in, your time to exercise. And if you're unable to exercise for that day for whatever reason, it'll just auto populate somewhere else. So it's a really cool app. But I just want to go ahead and say thank you guys for being on the podcast this week. You guys were really great. If you guys want to leave any feedback, we'd love to hear it on publisherlab.org or in the comments of YouTube or anywhere you listen to this podcast. One last time, thanks again to Zach Ashman and Terrence Timmons for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us on the Publisher Lab. We'll see you next week.